you would, go ahead and open your Bibles up to the book of Nehemiah. We'll be spending quite a bit of time in the book of Nehemiah this morning. And as we begin the lesson, I want to say, this is not a lesson to say we're not doing enough. This is one of those lessons that I think we need to be reminded sometimes, that we just need to be encouraged and edified to keep on keeping on. And that's my goal with the lesson this morning. I know it's one that I need to keep sometimes, we'll talk about it a little bit later. It's easy to get distracted away from some of the things that we need to be doing, and we need to be reminded that we have obligations and that we need to stick with the things that we're supposed to be doing. As we begin the study this morning, I do want us to have a little bit of a history lesson. I'm not real good with a lot of the dates and such, so I have them written down so that I can remember them. But it helps us to understand the setting of Nehemiah and what Nehemiah and the people of his day were going through and the things that they were doing. In 586 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar besieged Jerusalem and destroyed it. That's going to be coming up a little later in our Jeremiah study. The first captives are taken away in 586 B.C. by Nebuchadnezzar back to Babylon. That is during the time of Jeremiah and Ezekiel and Daniel and those prophets. At that time, Jerusalem was completely destroyed. And when it was destroyed, all the walls were torn down, the temple was destroyed, there was nothing essentially left to the city. By 465 B.C., I think I said 586 was the first captives. I think there were a few captives taken before that. That's the second part of the captivity. In 465 B.C., Babylon was overthrown. And Babylon was overthrown by the Medo-Persian Empire under a man by the name of Cyrus, who became known as Cyrus the Great. And he was able to enter into the city of Babylon and take it. And he put to death Belshazzar, who was the king of Babylon at that time, and it was in the house of Belshazzar that Daniel was serving at that time. In 445, a king by the name of Artaxerxes I comes to power over the Persian Empire. Artaxerxes I was the man who gave Ezra permission to go back to Jerusalem and begin the project of rebuilding the temple in Jerusalem. By the time we get to Nehemiah, it's been 13 years since Ezra went back to Jerusalem to restore worship and to build the temple. It's been over 80 years since the first captives returned to Jerusalem. And that was under Cyrus that had taken place. Now, as we start into the book of Nehemiah, what we see is that Nehemiah was the cupbearer for Artaxerxes. And that tells me that he had grown in importance among the servants in the house of Artaxerxes, because not just anybody would rise to the point of being the cupbearer for the king. It was a pretty prominent position among the servants. And it's pretty evident to me as I read for the first chapter of Nehemiah there that Nehemiah had developed a pretty good rapport with Artaxerxes. Artaxerxes liked him. And he gets by with some things that probably all of the servants would not be allowed to get by with. He does some things that not everybody. I think it took great courage on the part of Nehemiah to do what he does. But not every servant would have had the ability or the ear of Artaxerxes to be able to even ask those questions. Now, it's in that position as the cupbearer for Artaxerxes that we pick up the story or the account in Nehemiah chapter 1 and verse 1. The words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah, "It came to pass in the month of Chislev, in the 20th year, as I was in Shushan the citadel, that Hanani, one of my brethren, came with men from Judah, and I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped and who had survived the captivity, and concerning Jerusalem, and they said to me, 'The survivors who are left from the captivity in the province are there in great distress and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem is also broken down, and its gates are burned with fire.' So it was when I heard these words that I sat down and wept and mourned for many days. I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven." When we start out in this section, it's the temple has been rebuilt. Now, the temple was not rebuilt to the same grandeur that Solomon had built the temple. It wasn't nearly that nice. But it was rebuilt. Worship was being restored. That was the role and the job that Ezra had when he went back. But now they were trying to rebuild the walls. And in the rebuilding of the walls, they were not making much progress. What we see is that they were being hindered by several things. And that's going to continue even through the time of Nehemiah. Nehemiah hears this report from Jerusalem, and he becomes convinced that he was supposed to do something about it. And the very first thing that he does is that he prays before God. And if you read down through, we're not going to have time. We're going to read quite a bit this morning. We don't have time to read it all. But if you read down through part of this section, what you see is that Nehemiah goes to God on behalf of the people. He prays about their sin, and he pleaded with God to remember his promises to the people and to give aid to those who would be faithful to him. And he also pleaded with God that he might find favor in the eyes of the king, that Nehemiah himself would find favor in the eyes of the king, because he wasn't going to be able to accomplish anything if he did not have that favor of the king. And so, as we continue down through chapter 1, Nehemiah dedicated himself to fasting and to prayer. But in the process of that, we're told that Nehemiah's countenance fell. That is, he became sad. And that was something that was odd for him. Nehemiah said in chapter 2 and verse 1 that he had never been sad in the king's court before. And that's a pretty amazing thing. And he is serving as a servant, and yet he had never shown sadness in the king's court before. And that sadness drew the attention of the king. And he asked Nehemiah what was bothering him. And Nehemiah had to gather his courage to speak to the king and to approach him for this favor that he wanted. And that was unheard of. The servants would not go to the king and ask for favors. And so he had to really screw up his courage to be able to do that and to be able to ask the king for the things that he needed. So drop down to chapter 2 and verse 4. It says there, "Then the king said to me, 'What do you request?'" This is after he's identified him as being sad in the first few verses and talking to him about that. "And the king said, 'What do you request?' So I prayed to the God of heaven." A little bit of a side note. We're going to talk about the importance of prayer a little bit later. But notice what he did here. Immediately upon being asked this question, it says, Nehemiah prayed to God about it. Now, I don't think that this meant he said, "No, wait a minute, king. Let me go over here in the corner and kneel down and say a prayer out loud that God can hear." This is one of those instances in which, in the moment, he said a prayer to God before he speaks to the king. And there's a lot of wisdom in that. And the way, an approach that we need to think about is that when we're in a stressful, difficult situation, prayer is not something that has to be formal and vocal. It's something that can be quickly done, that we can talk to God before addressing the situation. Back to verse 5. "And I said to the king, 'If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in your sight, I ask that you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it.' Then the king said to me, 'The queen also sitting beside him, how long will your journey be, and when will you return?' So it pleased the king to send me, and I set him a time." Well, what we see is that Nehemiah asked the king to be allowed to go back to Judah, to be able to rebuild the walls that were there. And that's what the king allows Nehemiah to do. He allowed him to go back to Jerusalem, and this shows a lot of trust. Because if you notice, what the king said is, "How long will you be gone, and when will you be back?" And Nehemiah gives him those answers, that he has a plan in mind, that he's going to do a certain thing and then return to the service of the king. And so the king trusts Nehemiah to do just what he says that he's going to do. And I think that's important a little later in the account. Now, when Nehemiah gets to Jerusalem, it's not easy for him. There are a lot of obstacles to the work that arise that make it difficult for him to be able to do the job that he said that he was going to do. And so Nehemiah, as the leader in this circumstance, has to figure out how to overcome all of these obstacles. He's got to figure out what he's going to do to be able to do the work that was set before him to do. And he has a lot of enemies. And the enemies took every possible opportunity to oppose the work that he was trying to do. It starts with things like ridicule and mocking. In chapter 2 and verse 17, Nehemiah chapter 2, there in verse 17 beginning, it says, "Then I said to them, 'You see the distress that we are in, how Jerusalem lies waste, and its gates are burned with fire. Come and let us build the walls of Jerusalem, that we may no longer be a reproach.' And I told them of the hand of my God, which was upon, which had been good upon me, and also the king's words that he had spoken to me. So they said, 'Let us rise up and build.' Then they set their hands to do this good work. But when Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite, official, and Geshem the Arab heard of it, they laughed at us and despised us and said, 'What is this thing that you are doing? Will you rebel against the king?' So I answered and said to them, the God of heaven himself will prosper us. Therefore, we his servants will arise and build, but you have no heritage or right or memorial in Jerusalem." Now drop down to chapter 4. In chapter 4, we're going to begin in verse 1. "But it so happened when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall that he was furious and very indignant and mocked the Jews. And he spoke before his brethren and the army of Samaria and said, 'What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they fortify themselves? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they complete it in a day? Will they revive the stones from the heaps of rubbish, stones that are burned?' Now Tobiah the Ammonite was beside him, and he said, 'Whatever they build, if even a fox goes up on it, he will break down their stone wall. Hear, O God, for we are despised. Turn their reproach on their own heads, and give them as plunder to the land, to a land of captivity.'" These men were not going to be satisfied unless they were able to stop the construction of the walls of the city of Jerusalem completely. They started with these types of taunts. They mocked the people who were trying to accomplish what God wanted done. And they were hoping that they would be able to discourage them from continuing to do the work that they needed to do. Now, when ridicule didn't work, these men decided that they would fight against the people of Israel. Nehemiah chapter 4. We'll pick up in verse 7. Nehemiah 4 and verse 7. "Now it happened when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, and the Ashdodites heard that the walls of Jerusalem were being restored and that the gaps were beginning to be closed, that they became very angry, and all of them conspired together to come and attack Jerusalem and to create confusion. Nevertheless, we made our prayer to our God, and because of them we set a watch against them day and night. Then Judah said, 'The strength of the laborers is failing, and there is so much rubbish that we are not able to build the wall. And our adversary said, they will neither know nor see anything till we come into their midst and kill them and cause the work to cease. So it was when the Jews who dwelt near them came that they told us 10 times, from whatever place you turn, they will be upon us. Therefore I positioned the men behind the lower parts of the wall at the openings, and I set the people according to their families with their swords, their spears, and their bows. And I looked and arose and said to the nobles of the leaders and to the rest of the people, 'Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, great and awesome, and fight for your brethren, your sons and your daughters, your wives and your houses.' And it happened when our enemies heard that it was known to us and that God had brought their plot to nothing, that all of us returned to the wall, everyone to his work." See, Nehemiah was able to divert the plots of these wicked men as well. God, he said, was on their side. They were fighting for what was righteous, and God would fight for them. They would be victorious, and they were able to overcome those who were going to come and fight against them. When they knew they couldn't fight against them, they began to try and divert attention by bringing false charges against Nehemiah and against the people. Look down into chapter 6. We'll begin in verse 1 of chapter 6. Now it happened when Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem, the Arab, and the rest of our enemies heard that I had rebuilt the wall, and that there were no breaks left in it, though at the time I had not hung the doors and the gates, that Sanballat and Geshem sent to me, saying, "Come, let us meet together among the villages in the plain of Ono," but they thought to do me harm. So I sent messengers to them, saying, "I am doing a great work, so that I cannot come down. Why should the work cease while I leave it and go down to you?" But they sent me this message 4 times, and I answered them in the same manner. Then Sanballat sent his servant to me as before, the 5th time, with an open letter in his hand. In it was written, "It is reported among the nations, and Geshem says, that you and the Jews plan to rebel. Therefore, according to these rumors, you are rebuilding the wall, that you may be their king. And you have also appointed prophets to proclaim concerning you at Jerusalem, saying, 'There is a king in Judah.' Now these matters will be reported to the king, so come therefore and let us consult together." Then I sent to him saying, "No such thing as you say are being done, but you invent them in your own heart. For they all were trying to make us afraid, saying, 'Their hands will be weakened in the work, and it will not be done.'" So they begin to threaten Nehemiah. And they begin to tell that he was trying to raise up and become a king. And they threatened to report back to the king in Babylon what he was doing. And he says, "That's not going to work either. I'm not going to allow you to frighten us into not doing the work that is put before us." And so they tried one final thing, and that was they tried to trick Nehemiah into doing something that was contrary to the law. And again, they tried to use fear to do that. They thought that if they could get him to do something that was contrary to the law, then the people would even turn against Nehemiah. Look, beginning in verse 10 of chapter 6, he says, "Afterward, I came to the house of Shemaiah, the son of Delaiah, the son of Mehetabel, who was a secret informer. And he said, 'Let us meet together in the house of God within the temple, and let us close the doors of the temple, for they are coming to kill you. Indeed, at night they will come to kill you.' And I said, 'Should such a man as I flee? And who is there such as I who would go into the temple to save his life? I will not go in.' Then I perceived that God had not sent him at all, but that he pronounced this prophecy against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. For this reason he was hired, that I should be afraid and act that way and sin, so that they might have cause for an evil report, that they might reproach me. My God, remember Tobiah and Sanballat according to their works, and the prophetess Noadiah, and the rest of the prophets who would have made me afraid." So their plan was, let's make Nehemiah afraid and get him to flee into the temple and into the most holy place and hide there and violate the law, and then we'll have him and he'll have a bad report. And of course, Nehemiah was not willing to do that either. Now, during all of this time, one of the things that I noticed was that the Jewish nobles, the ones who should have been right at the front helping Nehemiah to lead, they decided that they weren't going to participate in the work. Back in chapter 3, which chapter 3 is a very interesting, you may have noticed we kind of skipped right over chapter 3 in some of the passages that we were reading. Chapter 3 is very interesting because what we see in chapter 3 is a list of all of the men who are busy about the work and what tribes they were from and that sort of thing, to show who was helping with the building of this wall as time was going on. But one thing that stood out to me from chapter 3 is that you have these leaders, these nobles, who should have been helping, who are refusing to. In verse 5 it says, "Next to them the Tekoites made repairs, but their nobles did not put their shoulders to the work of the Lord." They weren't willing to help. They weren't willing to do what they should have been doing. They even went so far as to try to take advantage of the situation in Jerusalem, and that they were attacking their own people financially. They were causing great hardship on the people. In chapter 5, In Nehemiah chapter 5, they're beginning in verse 1. And there was a great outcry of the people and their wives against their Jewish brethren. For there were those who said, "We, our sons and our daughters are many, therefore let us get grain that we may eat and live." There were also some who said, "We have mortgaged our lands and vineyards and houses that we might buy grain because of the famine." There were also those who said, "We have borrowed money for the king's tax on our land and vineyards. Yet now our flesh is as the flesh of our brethren, our children as their children. And indeed we are forcing our sons and daughters to be slaves, and some of our daughters have been brought into slavery. It is not in our power to redeem them, for other men have our land and our vineyards." And I became very angry when I heard their outcry in these words. After serious thought, I rebuked the nobles and the rulers, and I said to them, "Each of you is exacting usury from his brother." So I called a great assembly against them, and I said to them, "According to our ability, we have redeemed our Jewish brethren who were sold to the nations. Now indeed, will you even sell your brethren? Or should they be sold to us?" Then they were silenced and found nothing to say. These people were taxing their own brethren so severely that they were having to sell their children into slavery to be able to pay the taxes to keep up with things as they were going on. And Nehemiah rebukes them for that. They were destroying what was left there of their own people. Now that's not the worst of what they had done. Some of the nobles even refused to sever the dangerous ties they had with the very enemies that Nehemiah was fighting against. Down in chapter 6. There in verse 17. Chapter 6 and verse 17. It says, "Also in those days the nobles of Judah sent many letters to Tobiah, and the letters of Tobiah came to them. For many in Judah were pledged to him, because he was the son-in-law of Shechaniah, the son of Arah, the son of Jehonan, and married the daughter of Meshulam, the son of Berechiah. Also, they reported his good deeds before me and reported my words to him. Tobiah sent letters to frighten me." So these nobles are communicating with Tobiah, who is one of the men who is the greatest enemy of Nehemiah, trying to keep the walls from being built. And yet they're coming to Nehemiah and telling him what a good guy Tobiah is. What a good fella he is and all the good things that he's doing. And Nehemiah says, "Meantime, Tobiah is sending me threatening letters." He's threatening these things upon those of us who are trying to do what is right and what God has commanded us to do. I couldn't help but wonder how often Christians also maintain relationships with people of the world that are detrimental to their spiritual well-being. That they just keep right on continuing. I've had people who insist that wicked worldly people are so good, and we shouldn't condemn what they're doing because they're really good people. That's the same kind of attitude that these nobles had. And so it's not surprising that Satan is going to try the same tactics today to hinder our work in the building up of the church as he did with Nehemiah and those people in the building up of the wall. He's going to look for every opportunity to stop us from doing what we need to be doing. You remember how he's described in 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8? He is a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. That's his approach to those who are trying to do what is right. He's out there on the prowl, and he's not going to be satisfied until he gets us. He's going to try to stop the work from being done. And Satan will try to deceive us into doing something contrary to the will of God, just like Nehemiah was trying to be. They tried to deceive Nehemiah into doing that. John 8:44 tells us that he is the father of all lies. Look over at 2 Corinthians chapter 11. 2 Corinthians chapter 11, there in verse 12. Paul writes, But what I do, I will also continue to do, that I may cut off the opportunity from those who desire an opportunity to be regarded just as we are in the things of which they boast. For such are false apostles, deceitful workers, transforming themselves into apostles of Christ. And no wonder, for Satan himself transforms himself into an angel of light. Therefore, it is no great thing if his ministers also transform into ministers of righteousness, whose end will be according to their works. Satan is deceptive. Why is it surprising to us that his disciples are deceptive? We need to be on the lookout and know that they're going to be there trying to deceive us. But Nehemiah and his fellow workers never gave up. And I think that there is a lot that we can learn from their example. The things that their attitudes and some of the practices that they went through can help us to be devoted to the work that we have as well. And I want to look at a few things that help them to be successful in their work. One thing I want you to notice, and this is really at the heart of the rest of what we want to talk about, is one phrase that I find very interesting and very important in this context. In chapter 4, there in verse 6, Nehemiah says, "So we built the wall, and the entire wall was joined together up to half its height, for the people had a mind to work." How could Nehemiah accomplish all this? He couldn't have done this by himself. There's no way that he would have been able to build a wall around Jerusalem by himself. He says that we accomplished this because the people had a mind to work. They had a mind to work. They had determined that they were going to do what was set before them. And they worked hard, and Nehemiah worked hard to help keep that mindset on track. I think it's so easy, at least for me, it's so easy to become sidetracked from the work that we're supposed to be doing. It's so easy to have life get in the way. There are so many different things that we can be doing, and it's so easy to just absolutely fill our time up with all kinds of things of this world. Not that they're bad, not that they're wrong in and of themselves, but it works to sidetrack us sometimes from the things that we ought to be doing. And so there are some characteristics I want to look at for the remainder of our time this morning. Characteristics of these workers in Jerusalem that I think are worthy of our adopting them, of us acting like those people acted. The first one is that they were constantly in prayer. They were constantly watching the things that were going on around them. In chapter 4 there, in verse 9, Nehemiah says, "Nevertheless, we made our prayer to our God, and because of them, we set a watch against them day and night." Two things. We prayed and we watched what was going on. I think we need to have that same kind of attitude. We need to be prayerful and we need to be watching. We need to rely upon God for help and at the same time prepare ourselves for the things that could come from Satan, to know that we are ready for him. And that's the very attitude that I see in Jesus whenever he was in the garden, just shortly before he was going to be captured by the Jews. In Matthew chapter 26, do you remember the conversation as he went off to pray and came back and found his disciples sleeping? In Matthew 26 and verse 40, it says, "Then he came to the disciples and found them sleeping and said to Peter, 'What, could you not watch with me for 1 hour? Watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak.'" It's also the same kind of attitude that I think Jesus was talking about as he was warning about the coming of the day of judgment in Mark chapter 13. Mark chapter 13, beginning in verse 32. He says, "But of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. Take heed, watch and pray, for you do not know when the time is. It is like a man going into a far country who has left his house and gave authority to his servants and to each his work and commanded the doorkeeper to watch. Watch therefore, for you do not know when the master of the house is coming, in the evening, at midnight, at the crowing of the rooster, or in the morning, lest coming suddenly he finds you sleeping. And what I say to you, I will say to all. Watch. And so he expresses the same ideas there, that there is two parts. There is the watching, there is the praying. I believe that prayer has to be a constant part of our work. We need to talk about what our desires are, what our plans are, what the things that we want to accomplish. We need to talk to God about those things. Because if God is not a part of the work that we're going to be doing, it will not be successful. Nehemiah gave God the glory for what was happening. They were talking to Him all along the way. They put their confidence in God. And that's the same kind of thing, same kind of approach that we need to take as well. Another characteristic that I see in our context is that everybody came to work. We talked about, it was pointed out, those nobles that refused to work, they were the exception to the rule. The people came to work. In Nehemiah chapter 4, there in verse 15, "And it happened when our enemies heard that it was known to us and that God had brought their plot to nothing, that all of us returned to the wall, everyone to his work." The people who came out to help Nehemiah, they came with the attitude that they were going to do the work. Every person had a job, and they were diligent in fulfilling their job. I mentioned earlier, that's what chapter 3 talks about. It talks about what sections were assigned to what families and the responsibilities they had to fulfill their job in that section. They had to get that wall built in that section. The same thing is true in the work of the church today. Everyone can work. God has given us all responsibilities. He's given us all talents, things that we're capable of doing in the Lord's kingdom, and He expects us to be busy about those things. Ephesians chapter 4. In Ephesians chapter 4, they're beginning in verse 11. Paul wrote this, "And He Himself gave," speaking of Christ, "He Himself gave some to be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, and some pastors and teachers, for the equipping of the saints, for the work of ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ, till we all come to the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, to a perfect man, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ, that we should no longer be children, tossed to and fro and carried about with every wind of doctrine, but by the trickery of men and the cunning craftiness of deceitful plotting, but speaking the truth in love, may grow up in all things unto Him who is the head, Christ, from whom the whole body, joined and knit together by what every joint supplies according to the effective working by which every part does its share, causes growth of the body for the edifying of itself in love." There's an encouragement in that every part has a responsibility. What every joint supplies, every part, every person has an obligation. And the church doesn't grow the way that it ought to if I'm not doing my part or you're not doing your part. There are other passages that convey the same kinds of ideas in Romans chapter 12, 4 through 8. 1 Corinthians chapter 12, 12 through 26. The image is painted of Paul of the body and every part having a responsibility in the body. If we don't do our part, the body is not as strong as it could be. We've heard the old saying, a chain is only as strong as its weakest link. And churches are the same way. If there is weakness in the church, if there are those who are not doing their part, then the church is not as strong as it ought to be. Another characteristic of these people that I think is important is that these men came to work, but they also came ready to fight if the need arose. In Nehemiah chapter 4, in verse 16, beginning, it's right after we left off just a moment ago in verse 15 of saying everyone returned to his work. Verse 16 says, "So it was from that time on that half of my servants worked at construction while the other half held the spears, the shields, the bows, and wore armor. And the leaders were behind all the house of Judah. Those who built on the wall and those who carried burdens loaded themselves so that with one hand they worked at construction and with the other they held a weapon. Every one of the builders had his sword girded at his side as he built, and the one who sounded the trumpet was beside me. Then I said to the nobles, the rulers, and the rest of the people, the work is great and extensive, and we are separated far from one another on the wall. Wherever you hear the sound of the trumpet, rally to us there. Our God will fight for us. So we labored in the work, and half of the men held the spears from daybreak until the stars appeared. At the same time, I also said to the people, let each man and his servant stay at night in Jerusalem, that they may be our guard by night and a working party by day. So neither I, my brethren, my servants, nor the men of the guard who followed me took off our clothes, except that everyone took them off for washing. We need to never forget. These people understood that they had a job of building to do, but there was also a battle going on. And they needed to be prepared for both. And we need to remember that we are always in war as well. And we're supposed to be fighting for the side of God. A couple of weeks ago, we talked about Ephesians chapter 6, verses 10 through 20, and putting on the whole armor of God. We need to remember that we are in that battle, and we need that armor on, and that we're prepared to fight. And sometimes that's going to mean that we have to fight battles that are unpleasant. Sometimes within churches there is internal strife that arises, confrontations over doctrine that we have to make a determination we're going to stand up and fight against. And we need to be willing to stand up and fight. And then whenever there are battles that come from without, because there will always be battles that come from without, we need to be willing to stand up and fight against those as well. We need to be willing to stand up and fight when the going gets tough. Jude says that we are to contend earnestly for the faith. And I like that word that's used there for contend, because it means to struggle as with an adversary. That we're willing to stand up and fight against an adversary to defend that which is truth. We have that obligation to fight for what is right and to defend against what is wrong. Whatever the challenges are that might arise, we need to fight for the doctrine of Christ. We must stand up and fight for Him. But then we still have to keep in mind that there is a responsibility, no matter how hot the battle rages, there is a responsibility to the building as well. That there is an obligation to continue to build up the wall, to build up the church. The next thing that I want us to think about is these men were ready to assist one another. We read just a moment ago from chapter 4, verses 19 through 23, in which essentially one of the things that Nehemiah identifies there is he says, we're kind of spread out here. We're spread out on this wall, and when the threat comes, there is a need for us to help one another. So he says, listen for the blowing of the trumpet. And when you hear the blowing of the trumpet, you rush to that spot to help one another, to defend one another. If we want to have a successful work, we need to be willing to come to the aid of our brethren as well. And that's something that takes devotion on our part. You know, at least for me, it's easy for me to not think. There are some people that amaze me. They are so observant. They are so conscientious. They're so in tune with the needs of other people that they are there anytime there is a need. Sometimes I have to have somebody hit me over the head with a 2x4 to say, hey, I need something. I need your help here. And that's not the way that it ought to be. We need to be like those who identify issues. Now, here's one problem that I see in a lot of churches. And it's something that I think as we work here and build the church, you know, from scratch here, it's an important thing for us to develop. And that is, sometimes we as people are so strong in our own minds that we think we don't need any help. We never need any help. I'm baffled sometimes when people say, you find out after the fact that they've been sick, maybe some serious sickness. And they say, well, we just didn't want to bother anybody. We can't help one another if we don't know where the problems are in people's lives. We can't be of assistance. We can't pray for people if we don't know what's going on in other people's lives. And so we need to understand that the church is supposed to be the family of God. And as family, we share with one another. And we show people our weaknesses. And when they understand when we need help. And that's the way we ought to interact as God's children. That we need to be the kind of people that are willing to be helped. It's the kind of people who are willing to be helped that are also the kind of people who are willing to help. Look at Romans chapter 12. Romans chapter 12. We're going to begin reading in verse 9. Paul writes, "Let love be without hypocrisy. Abhor what is evil, cling to what is good. Be kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love and honor, giving preference to one another. Not lagging in diligence, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord, rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation, continuing steadfastly in prayer, distributing to the needs of the saints, given to hospitality." This passage is in the greater context of Paul writing about what our obligation is as we are Christians. Notice how many of those things are focused on one another. That we are to look out for one another. Paul told the Galatian brethren in Galatians 5 and verse 13 that they were to serve one another. He told them that they have the responsibility to look out for one another's spiritual well-being in chapter 6 and verses 1 and 2. Those are grave responsibilities that are placed upon us in the church. And they're things that we cannot shirk. The last thing I want you to think about is that these people stayed until the work was done. This shows their dedication. It shows their devotion to the work. In Nehemiah chapter 6 and verse 15, Nehemiah said that the wall was finished in 52 days. That is just an absolutely amazing feat. That they were able to rebuild the whole wall around Jerusalem in 52 days. And it does show the dedication that they had. And that's the kind of dedication that we need to have as well. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15. 1 Corinthians chapter 15. There in verse 58, Paul wrote, "Therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your labor is not in vain in the Lord." Look at the words that he uses there to say what we're supposed to be. Be steadfast, be immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord. Is that the kind of dedication that we have? That we're never wavering from the responsibilities that God has given to us? It is easy for us to become discouraged in our work. But the goal is to put our faith and our confidence in God. If our faith and our confidence is in God, like those people that were working on that wall, we're not going to give up on Him. Galatians chapter 6 and verse 9 tells us, "Let us not grow weary while doing good, for in due season we shall reap if we do not lose heart." We can't give up on the job. We can't give up on the work. You remember what Paul said in 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verses 6 through 8 as he was nearing the end of his life? He was able to emphatically speak about the reward that he was going to receive. "I have fought a good fight. I have finished the course. I have kept the faith. And therefore there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness." But he says at the end of that, "Not for me only, but all those who have loved His appearing." You know, he was talking there about the confidence he had in God, not in himself. That God was going to fulfill the promises that He gave to him because he had remained steadfast to the end. And that's what our obligation is. We need to be devoted to doing the will and the work of God. Well, we can be successful in the work here as we attempt to build a work here in Bozeman. And I think these five characteristics that we've identified from the people of Nehemiah's day, Nehemiah and those that were with him, can help us to be successful in our work. They were successful in building the wall. We can be successful in building up the Lord's church. He's told they were a people that were watchful and they were prayerful. And we need to be that. They came to work. They were dedicated to the work. But they were also ready to fight, and that was the third thing. They were willing and ready to help one another, and they were determined to work until the work was finished. And those are all characteristics that we need to adopt if we're going to be the faithful servants of God as well. Thanks for your good attention this morning.